From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with comedian Joy Behar, who's found new fame as the wisecracking but peacemaking member of the raucous daytime talk show The View. She's also just written an autobiography called Joystick. And in recognition of National Poetry Month, Charles Simic, the Serbian-born poet, has a new collection called Jackstraws, and he'll share his thoughts on the present-day war in Kosovo. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Dreamland, a new novel about turn-of-the-century New York. Plus, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz discusses an unusual work by composer Arnold Schoenberg in a new recording. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, critic at large for Entertainment Weekly, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest Joy Behar is best known these days as part of the daily gathering of women, including Barbara Walters, Meredith Vieira, and Star Jones, who form The View. It's a daily ABC talk show that has attracted a fervent following and has received a high pop culture accolade, numerous parodies on Saturday Night Live. A sort of highly caffeinated coffee klatch, The View has made a star of Behar, a stand-up comic who is often the show's voice of skepticism and common sense. Behar has just written a new book called Joystick that chronicles her life as a Brooklyn girl, a young mother, a divorcee, a comedian, and now a View guru. Joy Behar, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Ken.
After years as a stand-up comic, you suddenly have this nationwide public forum every morning on The View to, you know, express your opinions seriously and amusingly. How has being on The View changed your life?
Well, I'm much more recognizable now, so that when I go shopping, everyone at Bloomingdale's stops and talks to me. In the old days, it was hard to get a salesperson to even take my order.
How were you originally recruited to be on the show? I'm making it sound like you're joining the army. You're recruited.
I know.
Or something.
Well, it's interesting. I went to a 89th birthday party for Milton Berle, believe it or not. Someone asked me if I would go and perform at this birthday party, right, as a stand-up. So I went, and I really didn't even know too many people. There were a lot of celebrities, and I got up, and I did some shtick about Milton and his wife, the fact that he's, you know, he was 89 and his wife was 50. And I did a whole bunch of things about how, you know, women, men will, they'll be 100, they'll be in their grave, they're still getting married. And women, you know, can't find a guy. For example, the example I gave was that Salman Rushdie had gotten married 3 times in the past 10 years, and he was in hiding and never even left his hotel room. And yet he managed to find a wife, I think, 3 times.
Right.
Anyway, that was sort of the fun of it. And then Barbara Walters happened to be a guest. And after I was done, she said to Regis Philbin, who was that woman? And then a few months later, I got a call to be on The View with her. It was quite exciting.
And now, is it true that Barbara Walters had to overcome some resistance to your being on the show because some network people thought you were too New York?
Well, too New York is something I've been hearing for a long time. I mean, I don't know what it's a code word for, but it's certainly something I've always heard, as if there's something wrong with being too New York.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to me that the roles that you all take on, that Barbara Walters is like the prim mother, Star Jones is this odd combination of lawyer and diva, and Meredith Vieira is the ditzy middle sister. But you're the one I look to puncture any kind of pretension or to come in with the zinger that'll chop off some argument that's been going on for too long.
I think that's interesting that you say it that way, because Meredith had a bunch of brothers.
Yeah.
You know, Star is the older sister, and Barbara was the older sister, I believe, or else if she wasn't, she had to take care of the family because her father lost his business at some point, and she had to basically support the family. And I was the only child in my family with a bunch of Italian relatives around, and every time they'd get maudlin, my function would be to jump up and say, you know, something funny to break them out of their depression.
Right.
Or if they were pretending to be something other than what they were, I wouldn't let them get away with it. So yeah. We're all doing the same roles that we did when we were kids.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's why it's worked out so well.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? And then, of course, we had Debbie there, and it didn't work out for her for some reason. And it's a funny thing. I wonder if it has something to do with her position in the family.
Yeah, it could be. Now, what was the deal with Debbie? How come she didn't work?
It just didn't work out. I mean, it doesn't always work out, you know, for people. And she's doing really well now. She's got some kind of a pilot deal, and she's on to other things. Move along, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, before you entered show business, you started out in that great stand-up comedy Breeding Ground teaching English in junior high school.
Right. Junior high and high school.
Yeah. Were you a good teacher?
You know, I worked in a few different schools, and I think depending on the school, I was better in some situations than others.
Uh-huh.
You know, when I taught high school dropouts, I actually, I liked that job very much because they were young people who came back to school.
They wanted
some
to
of
be
them
there.
Were, yeah, they wanted to be there. They had screwed up in the first place, and now they're back for their second chance. So I like teaching those kids. And a lot of times, they were very bright kids who had gotten some bad breaks. And that's I like teaching kids like that who were motivated and had some trouble, you know, in their lives and now were ready to work.
Yeah. But were you a tough teacher?
In some school, one school I was known to be a strong disciplinarian. I can't believe that they ever said that about me. All I can say is their other teachers must have been horrifying, you know, and just like let them just run amok compared to me because I was hardly strict.
Right.
But, I mean, I did learn after a while you don't smile for 6 months when you're a teacher because they'll take advantage of you if they think that you're easy and you're fun.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit difficult. I was much more fun in the teacher's room, I think.
Really? It was a smaller room to work, probably.
Much smaller. I was always looking for a bigger room to work. I think that's what my whole raison d'etre has been.
Right. It seems like it's very typical of female comedians from Phyllis Diller to Roseanne when she was doing stand-up as Roseanne Barr to put down their husbands and talk about how stultifying their lives as housewives were. But, you know, in your book, Joystick, this was not a comic premise. This was really what your life was like to a certain extent. Where do we begin? I mean, you had a long marriage that went bad. You had a difficult...
It ended. You know, it was okay. It was good for a while, you know? I mean, marriages to me are not all great or all bad. And even the ones that end in divorce have their great times.
Yeah.
You know?
How
but
long were
just,
you married?
I was married 16 years.
Yeah.
And I was happily married for some part of that. But I
what,
was
What
really...
percentage of that?
Probably between 40 and 45.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Percent, not bad.
No.
The other percentage of it, I can't even say whether I was happy or I wasn't happy. I was just dying to do something else.
Yeah.
I felt as though I was in a situation that I didn't like being married.
Yeah.
I don't like the institution.
Yeah. What is it about the institution that chafes?
One of my girlfriends said that she doesn't mate in captivity. I forget who said that.
Uh-huh.
But there's something about... this idea that you're legally bound that strikes me as being in shackles.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is, but I just don't like it. And since that time, I have a boyfriend. We have a very steady relationship for the past 16 years. But he lives in the Bronx and I live in Manhattan. We don't live together and we're not getting married.
I'm talking with Joy Behar, co-host of The View and author of a new book, Joystick, which is subtitled, What is the Existential Vacuum and Does It Come with Attachments? Gee, it's good that you can laugh at the subtitle of your own book.
Well, it's such a crazy title.
Yes.
You know, I think that you want to know about the title?
Yeah.
Well, one day my girlfriend Jane and I were hanging around being housewives at some point and writing comedy together years and years ago. And we were just talking about the life in general, I suppose. And she said to me, you know what? What is the existential vacuum anyway? And I said, yeah, and does it come with attachments? And it was a phrase that just stuck with me all these years. And then I realized, you know, I grew up in an Italian family. We were all attached at the hip. You know, I don't know if you had a similar situation, Ken, when you were a child, but I lived in a tenement building on the 5th floor walk-up. My grandmother and my aunts lived on the 3rd floor. I was constantly shuttling up and down those stairs. We were together all the time. And when I was taken out to exit 60, I acted as though I was taken there involuntarily. I actually moved there with my husband. I confronted the existential vacuum. I could not tolerate the isolation, you know, because I was not raised like that.
Yeah.
And I guess this phrase, does it come with attachments? It was like almost like some weird phrase that came into my head. But in retrospect, it has meaning to me.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? Or I'm not making any sense?
No, absolutely.
I'm making sense?
You're making sense. I mean,
you know, you're in big trouble, Ken. You think that I'm making sense.
Now, I want to go back, though, because you also had this job as a receptionist at Good Morning America.
Good Morning America and I can't shake it, because once you're fired from a television show, a television job, people will drive you crazy with that. But I was a receptionist at Good Morning America. And they love to talk about that, because 6 months after I was fired, I was a guest.
Oh.
So my career took off right after I got fired from Good Morning America, which should be very encouraging to people listening who have been fired or who think that they're going to be fired. It's an opening.
I would think so. But I also would think you would not be one to suffer fools gladly answering the phones.
Oh, I was the worst receptionist. I mean, if you read if you read my chapter in Joystick about the way I would answer the phones, it was really horrifying. But I mean, you know, they'd call me up and they'd say, was that Albert Speer you had on this morning? And I'd say, yes. They'd say, Albert Speer, the Nazi? I'd say, yeah. Well, how could you have a Nazi on television? I'd say, well, look, what do you want from me? I don't book this show. And it's sweeps week, you know? And they would be horrified.
Yeah.
And then they'd call from, you know, I don't know, from Nebraska or you know, up in Vancouver. And they'd say, well, was David Hartman wearing his Lucas Tanner pants? And I'd say, well, can't you get a life? What are you calling me from Vancouver to find this out? I was the worst receptionist, Ken, you can imagine.
Well, good for you. You were destined for bigger things. Well, let's take a short break here. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. If you've just joined us, we're talking to Joy Behar, co-host of The View and author of a new book, Joystick. What was it like the first time you actually went up on a stage to do stand-up? Had you written all your own material and had a little routine to do?
The very first time that I did it, my girlfriend Jane Bowling and I, we had written this material called with a character called Sadie Catalano. She gave news in the neighborhood. It was a character. I wore a hat. I wore glasses. And it was based on a person that I knew in the neighborhood who was quite the yenta. And she would know everybody's business. And so we made up this whole routine, which would be like, you know, only a hail of bullets marred the festivities as wedding bells rang for Camilla Rose Caratucci, you know. Former bodyguard Carmine Russo has become a faith healer. There isn't a cripple left in the neighborhood, you know, since Carmine has been pronouncing his miraculous words, walk or I'll break both your legs. And this was the material.
Right.
So I got up on stage one night at the Improv and I tried this out. And it killed at 10 o'clock at night. It was a packed house. Then try and get another spot after that. They put me on at 2 o'clock in the morning with three drunks from exit 14 on the Jersey Turnpike. And there I am bombing and dying like a dog. So I was always having setbacks, and it was it was very, very hard. It would take me 6 months to get back up on stage.
Just because it was just so
demoralizing? It was so devastating.
Yeah.
Even if I would do well, it took me 6 months to get back.
Yeah.
I can't even explain it. I just couldn't. I'm still nervous about it. I'm stuttering as I tell you.
Now, you write in the book, many blue jokes are more easily accepted by an audience when they're spoken by men.
Yes, I think that's true.
Yeah, why do you think that is?
Well, I think that we still suffer from those stereotypes that women are supposed to be fragile and delicate and demure and ladylike.
Mm-hmm.
The word ladylike, I mean, the word gentlemanlike is a mouthful. You hardly ever hear it. But ladylike, doesn't that trip over the tongue?
Right.
So I think that, you know, and to see a woman using language that we use as stand-up comedians is off-putting to some people. And a lot of the former generation before mine, for example, Steve Allen is complaining about the language, and a lot of other people do.
Yeah.
And I think that has to do with women.
Mm-hmm.
partly it's because we're women, and also, you know, we have a microphone in our hands, of course, and that's a little off-putting too.
Right. Were there women that you admired as comedians?
Well, when I was growing up, there used to be the Ed Sullivan Show had a woman named Jean Carroll. I don't know if you remember her, Ken.
No, I don't.
How old you are?
No.
But she was the only stand-up comedian I used to see when I was a kid. And then as I grew older, I saw Toadie Fields, who I always thought was hilarious. And
really
Joan
funny.
Rivers.
Yeah.
Really, really funny.
Yeah.
And Joan is very funny also, and Phyllis Diller. And those were the role models, basically.
Yeah.
But, you know, it still didn't seem like a logical thing for me to do.
Yeah. Well, the ultimate inner sanctum for at least older male comics is the Friars Club.
Yeah.
This is
a gay bar without the good-looking guy.
But this is a sanctum that you have managed to penetrate, so to speak.
Yes. Thank you. That was a good one.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I was going to say you hosted a roast for Danny Aiello.
Well, I was the first female roast master for the Friars Club in 93 years.
Wow.
I said to them, well, welcome to the 16th century.
Right.
And, yes, Danny Aiello was our subject, and we made the poor man cry. We were brutal to him that day. But I walked a fine line that day because of this. You want to be funny and you want to be blue. Because
yep.
That's what the roasts are.
Yeah.
But you have to watch it because you're a woman and you want to be like a, you know, a little bit feminine. So mm-hmm. I hope that I succeeded there.
Yeah. Well, if he was crying, I'm sure you succeeded.
He was crying, but yeah. He was crying because Richard Belzer, who is ruthless.
Yes, who many people only know now in Homicide, but is a great stand-up comedian.
Oh, I mean, Richard Belzer was one of the most original comedians. Very, very original. He's the one who started this right babe. You know, you'll hear people do this all the time and say, I like your hair that way. Yeah, right babe.
Yeah.
That's Richard, you know. He always was very, very irreverent. And the day of Danny Aiello's roast, I mean, he didn't even prepare any jokes. All he did was he got up and he read reviews of Danny's show, Della Ventura, which was scathing. They were horrifying. And Danny had not even heard them yet. He was in tears. The man, to see a grown Italian man brought to tears is quite devastating.
But it's a great idea.
I said to Richard later, did you feel guilty? And he said, no. It was funny.
Well, if you're just joining us, my guest is Joy Behar, co-host of The View, and she's the author of a new book, Joy Shtick. You write quite a bit in the book about growing into middle age and how it's not a bad thing at all. I liked your line about if you're getting married, suddenly the phrase till death do us part doesn't sound so horrible.
Well, it's not the damned eternity it was 25 years ago.
Right. What is it about middle age that's good?
I like middle age very much. I mean, childhood is a nightmare. Let's tell the truth here. And old age can be a nightmare if you're infirm.
Mm-hmm.
So your greatest years, your wonder years, the wonder years when you were like, I don't know, 12,
right.
Those are not the wonder years. The wonder years are between 40 and 60. You get your act together, you're strong, you're healthy, you still look good. You can still enjoy a good orgasm. Hey, who's better than you?
You can go on The View and talk about it.
Exactly.
The other interesting thing I've read in the book was that you're friends with both Gloria Steinem and the literary critic Camille Paglia.
Professor Paglia.
Yes.
She's the professor.
How did you get chummy with them? Did you referee some feminist dogfight or something?
No. They don't talk to each other particularly.
Yeah,
they both talk to me.
Right.
Gloria and I, you know each other from the Ms. Foundation. She knows me when we had a radio show on WABC Radio. A lot of people listen to that show.
Mm-hmm.
And I know her. I've done benefits for the Ms. Foundation, and I admire Gloria Steinem tremendously. Camille Paglia is a great comedy fan, and she saw my HBO special. And she got in touch with me and wrote me letters and told me how much she admired me. And we became friends, and I've interviewed her at the 92nd Street Y. Yeah.
Well, now, speaking of Barbara Walters, I know that The View is kind of her baby beyond just appearing a few times a week on the panel.
Right.
In what ways is she involved behind the scenes?
Well, she's one of the two executive producers.
Yeah.
And her company, Barwall, is part owner of the show with ABC.
Yeah.
So she basically, it's her baby.
Yeah.
That's right.
So does she have, like, approval for guests or topics and stuff like that?
Well, she does. She could have it, but she doesn't really have enough time to do that much with it. But, you know, if she doesn't want something, she says it.
Right.
She's involved in the planning of it quite a bit. Of course, we, you know, she seems so shocked sometimes when we say things at that Hot Topics table.
Yeah.
And that's for real, because she doesn't know what we're going to say.
Really.
And she really does not clamp on us very much at all.
No.
She lets us go. I mean, but then she puts her hand on her head and shakes her head like, you know, be careful what you wish for.
That's right.
She got it.
Yeah. You have to be careful.
Yes. Well, Meredith is the loosest cannon on The View, isn't she?
I think she is, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, now that
you never know what she's going to come up with. She doesn't wear underwear. Her breasts fall out of her clothing. She's wacky.
Yeah. Yes, it's true. Now that Debbie's not there. I got the feeling I'm never going to get the real story about Debbie from you.
Well, you know, we're picking a new girl.
Yeah. Are you ever going to pick that new co-host? This is
yes.
Like such a tease. Every morning I come and there's a different young woman there. And I love the remarks you've made about some of them, too. Half of which I can't even repeat here. But
Why can't you repeat it here? I said it on television.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know.
But we are going to announce it on May 3rd, and I think that's Monday.
Oh, okay. All right,
yeah,
finally.
You'll hear the new one. It's down to three of them.
All right, so our long national nightmare will finally be over.
Thank goodness.
That's right.
We can rest now.
You'll finally have some new young person to pick on.
Right.
Your life is great now. You're a
TV. I'm having fun.
You're a TV star.
I don't like to say my life is great. I'm a little superstitious. You know, you don't go around saying that. You give me a kanahara.
Oh, okay.
Everyone thinks I'm Jewish because I know every Jewish word. Isn't it amazing? I always say, you know, no one believes me that I'm Italian. A few years ago, I got a call, Happy Hanukkah. I said, Ma, I'm not Jewish.
Isn't it like once you're in show business, you're automatically Jewish?
I think it's once you're in New York.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Reba McEntire is perceived as Jewish, do you?
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
And so is there anything that's unsettling in your life? Anything that's still disturbing you? Anything you still want to accomplish?
You know what it is? It's like I don't think about it anymore like that. I'm just sort of on a roll.
Yeah.
I'd like to have a weekend away in the country.
Uh-huh.
But other than that, I'm just doing it. You know, it's not like the old days where I was so blocked and I could not get the confidence and I could not get the, I don't know what was going on with my head, but I just couldn't do it. I was petrified. And now I'm completely the opposite in that way. So I look forward to the day. I look forward to working, to stand up, to going out on vacation, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's just fun.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Ken. This was fun.
Joy Behar. Her new book is called Joystick. I'm Ken Tucker. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BA. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from garden.com, an online source for gardening advice and home delivery of over 14,000 plants, tools, and gardening products. Bantam Books, publisher of Sabbath, Restoring the Sacred Rhythm of Rest by Wayne Muller, available in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Dreamland, a new novel about New York in the early 1900s. Poet Charles Simic appreciates the part of the room we notice the least, the ceiling. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz extols the eccentric virtues of Pierrot Lunaire, a striking work by composer Arnold Schoenberg. This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker. Kevin Baker's new novel, Dreamland, revisits turn-of-the-century New York. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says Dreamland, like New York itself, contains multitudes.
It's almost impossible to write a bad novel about New York City if the city itself is your main character. New York is so rich in history and possibility that all you have to do is start listing place names like Delancey Street, Central Park, the Brooklyn Bridge, and you have, well, maybe not a great novel, but a book that'll command attention. That's the respectable category that Kevin Baker's Dreamland falls into. This fat club sandwich of a novel about New York in 1910 is layered with so much meaty historical detail, salty street life, and schmaltz that a reader needs buckets of spare time and seltzer to wash it all down. Baker deliberately mickeys around with his facts so that everybody and everything, even vaguely in the vicinity of New York in 1910, takes a bow in Dreamland. Thomas Edison, Francis Perkins, Samuel Gompers, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, street Arabs, the public saltwater baths on the North River, and the Lower East Side dives that served up cocktails of beer and chloral hydrate. Sigmund Freud even visits the city, as he really did in 1909. In Baker's story, Freud pees in his pants while visiting Columbia University and then takes a breather in Coney Island, the plaster and paint id of the city, where he's set upon by a pack of impish dwarfs. Who knows? This is New York. It could have happened. There is a plot and a central setting here, Dreamland, one of the three amusement parks that really existed long ago in Coney Island. It's a place where, as its visionary architect creator says, we manufacture the carnival spirit in this manufacturing age. Every weekend, Dreamland is overrun by shop girls and factory hands searching for a bit of transcendence. Esther Essie Abramowitz is one of those huddled masses. She's a young woman who works as a sewing machine operator in a sweatshop. And though she's no beauty, she catches the eye of Kid Twist, a petty gangster with a heart of gold. Because of a melodramatic plot revelation I won't disclose, Kid Twist's underworld rival, Jip the Blood, a thug who breaks men's backs over his knees, threatens to murder the couple. But enough of this Damon Runyon-esque nonsense about gangsters and their malls. Essie, Kid Twist, and the rest of the cast of thousands here primarily functions like those poor guys you still sometimes see trudging around the streets of New York wearing sandwich board signs. They're walking, talking stick figures on which Baker can hang his outlandish but based in truth advertisements and stories about the turn of the century city. And those stories are the real draw here. Stories like Kid Twist's recollection of how, as a stowaway, he made his entrance into America by diving off a boat at night into New York Harbor, where he fought his way to the surface through chicken guts, drowned rats, and all the other filth surrounding the great city. Or Essie's description of her fellow tenement dwellers on a sweltering summer's night, wrapped in sheets and sleeping on fire escapes and roofs, pried out of their apartments like soft white oysters. As a New York semi-historical novelist, Baker is inevitably being compared to E.L. Doctorow, though he's nowhere near Doctorow's neighborhood, lacking, among other things, Doctorow's political punch. Baker's idea of political commentary is to make cute inside jokes, like naming a pair of sweatshop managers Podhoretz and Crystal. If you don't get it, never mind. Dreamland doesn't even quite measure up to the sections of Susan Isaac's latest novel, Red, White, and Blue, that describe early 20th century immigrant New York with loads more wit and attitude. But whenever Baker subdues his literary carnival acts and just lets his New York stories and places speak for themselves, Dreamland becomes captivating. With a city this fantastic as its subject, how could it not?
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Dreamland by Kevin Baker. Coming up, poems by Pulitzer Prize winner Charles Simic and his thoughts on the war in Kosovo. This is Fresh Air. My guest Charles Simic has published more than a dozen books of poetry. His new one is called Jackstraws. He's also contributed a poem and an autobiographical essay to a new anthology called Letters of Transit. Five authors reflect on exile, identity, language, and loss. Simic was born in 1938 in Belgrade, Yugoslavia. He came to America when he was 15. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his 1989 book, The World Doesn't End, and he's the editor of a book of Serbian poetry called The Horse Has Six Legs. I wanted him to read some of his own very American poetry, as well as get his thoughts on the current situation in Kosovo. Charles Simic, welcome to Fresh Air.
Very nice to be here.
I'd like to begin by asking you to read a poem from your new book, Jackstraws. It's called On a Lack of Respect Paid to the Ceiling.
All of you bummed out and in a deep funk, ornery, spiteful mopes with your noses dragging the floor, you are not giving proper reverence and esteem to the imperious, the ever-looming, rarely remembered and scrutinized overseer of all your goings-on. There may be a green dragonfly just now consulting its dainty shadow, the excited movement of leaves, the mystery of light changing, or there may be nothing there to see. Note, please, how quiet the world gets when you roll your eyes back and look.
That poem seems typical to me of your work in the sense that it takes a very simple idea, the notion of something we take for granted, the ever-present ceiling over our heads, and explores it from a number of different angles, yielding an emotional insight. Can you remember why the ceiling occurred to you as an organizing image for that poem?
Ceilings are, as I say in this poem, I mean, they're kind of invisible in a sense. And the only time one remembers to look at the ceiling is when one is exasperated or inspired or something unusual happens. One throws up one's hands and there is the ceiling. And then you say, my God, you know, how did that water stain get there? So, yes, I mean, this has been a constant subject with me to discover obvious places that are, you know, around us but are not, for some reason, noticed.
Now, you're a Serb who came to America from Yugoslavia when you were 15, I think, around the time of World War II. What do you remember about your life around that time, during that war?
Well, lots of things. Obviously, I was born in 1938, and my conscious life sort of begins in a big way on April 6th, 1941, 5 o'clock in the morning, when a bomb hit across the street. I mean, I lived in downtown Belgrade, and the Nazis bombed Belgrade on April 6th.
Could you describe a little more about what that was like? I mean, what did you eat? What did it smell like?
Well, first of all, it's, you know, it's kind of claustrophobic. It's everybody's, you know, squeezed in a space which was not intended to, you know, for people to be there. I mean, there were usually things like people would keep wood because we had wood burning stoves, coal burning stoves, and you know, the usual junk that people keep in cellars. So we were there, and what I remember is this sort of very strange sound of as the bombs kind of landed muffled, slightly muffled sound, depending how far it was. And then, you know, sound of glass shattering someplace or something, you know, breaking. And then you were trying to kind of imagine what the hell could it be, you know, breaking or collapsing or whatever.
Were you very frightened or did you pretty quickly become used to that?
Well, I don't remember really being frightened. I was just the other day, I was remembering how this is 1944, bombings. There was a boy in our building who was a bit older than I was, and he had snuck out during the bombing to watch it. And his mother noticed that he was missing, so after a while, a couple of fellows brought him back. I guess he had gone on the street. And his mother started slapping him around, you know, yelling at him, saying, you know, the usual stuff, like, I'm going to kill you if you ever do this again. And I remember being more frightened of her slaps, you know, than of bombs falling.
It's much more immediate danger.
Much more immediate danger.
Yeah.
I mean, I have memories of kind of sudden being startled, by an explosion, but not, a permanent state of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And then now, you know, in the same building, the same house where I was born, where I still have relatives, they're back in a cellar. And this is the third time in 58 years that they're being bombed. The TV studio that was destroyed about a week ago is about 100 yards from the house.
Really? So you literally have relatives in that same house?
Yeah, yeah.
And are you...
And the same cast of characters in the cellar, you know. Not exactly the same. I mean, I'm missing, but...
Right.
A few others.
And are you in contact with them in any way?
Yes. You can call them.
You can?
Yeah. Although sometimes you can get them while the bombs are falling. People would stick a phone out of the window and you know, say, you know, listen to the sirens. I haven't heard any bombs like that, but I mean, but yes, you can reach them.
And how do they describe the atmosphere there? What is it like?
Well, you know, it's pure hell. I mean, it's, bombings of cities are, I mean, despite what anybody says, are a form of collective punishment. You know, they're out to get you. So it's very frightening and it's very difficult for all people, you know, to get food, you know, to just, you know, manage their daily existence, which is, you know, typical.
If you're just joining us, my guest is the poet Charles Simic. I'd like to ask you to read the poem that precedes your essay in the book Letters of Transit.
Sure.
The poem is called Cameo Appearance.
I had a small non-speaking part in a bloody epic. I was one of the bombed and fleeing humanity. In the distance, our great leader crowed like a rooster from a balcony. Or was it a great actor impersonating our great leader? That's me there, I said to the kiddies. I'm squeezed between the man with two bandaged hands raised and the old woman with her mouth open as if she were showing us a tooth that hurts badly. The 100 times I rewound the tape, not once could they catch sight of me in that huge gray crowd that was like any other gray crowd. Trot off to bed, I said finally. I know I was there. One take is all they had time for. We ran, and the planes grazed our hair. And then there were no more, as we stood dazed in the burning city. But, of course, they didn't film that.
Who's the they you're referring to in terms of filming that?
Well, actually, this all comes from once flipping channels and catching a bit of a footage of an old documentary, World War II documentary, where they show the bombing of April 6, 1941, the Nazi bombing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen this many times before, But this one time, there was additional footage. Just, I don't know, maybe 30 seconds of additional footage. And what was astonishing, must have been the Nazis because it was from the air. I saw my neighborhood, and I saw quite a few destroyed buildings. And I, for the first time, I realized how many bombs fell on my head that day. And then what I also remember from, not so much even from that bombing, but later on from bombings, where the sort of the scene where, you know, after it's over, people, you know, walk out into the street to come out from their cellars, and the astonishment of, you know, looking down a certain block, and all of a sudden, you know, the building that stood there before, you know, is no more. I thought maybe in one of these crowds, because there are some other additional part of this documentary when they were crowds in Belgrade. I kind of imagine myself. I must have been there at this time while this was going on. Where was I exactly? Was I in the street or was I at home? So that was the conceit of the poem.
Well, Charles Simic, I'd like to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Serbian-born poet Charles Simic. His new collection of poems is Jackstraws. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz talks about a highly influential composition by Arnold Schoenberg. This is Fresh Air. Arnold Schoenberg's Pierrot Linaire was a landmark piece for its composer. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says it's one of the strangest, but also one of the most influential works of the century. There's a new recording by one of the master conductors of modern music, Pierre Boulez. Here is Lloyd's review.
In 1912, the year before the premiere of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring triggered the most notorious musical riot of the century, Arnold Schoenberg was creating a quieter revolution. He was slowly obliterating the system of tonality as it had been known for centuries, and his expressionistic masterpiece, Pierrot Lunaire, which might be translated as Moonstruck Pierrot, was a major step on that thorny path. For someone who was unraveling musical structure, Schoenberg was also obsessively organized. Pierrot Lunaire was his opus 21, so he assembled 21 poems in three sets of seven by the Belgian poet Albert Giraud about the lovesick clown Pierrot, the Commedia dell'arte character in white face and loose, baggy white silks. The complicated form of these poems is the rondo, 13 lines, one line short of a sonnet, in three stanzas. The first two lines of each poem reappear at the end of the second stanza. Then the opening line comes back again as the last line of the poem. Each poem is a closed circle, claustrophobic, returning to where it started with no way out. The most conspicuous effect is how the words are recited. Schoenberg used the term Sprechstimme or Sprechgesang, a kind of sung speech, Each syllable has a specific pitch and duration. It's like a very expressive parent reading to a child. But these poems are hardly for children. They deal symbolically and sometimes with moments of grim comedy, with questions of art, sexual longing, nostalgic yearning, terror, and guilt. Chopin Waltz. As a lingering drop of blood stains the lip of a consumptive, so this music is pervaded by a morbid, deathly charm. Wild, ecstatic harmonies disguise the icy touch of doom as a lingering drop of blood stains the lip of a consumptive. Ardent, joyful, sweet and yearning, melancholic, somber waltzes coursing ever through my senses, leaving an insipid aftertaste like a lingering drop of blood.
Wie ein blasser Tropfen Bluts färbt die Lippen einer Kranken. Also ruht auf diesen Tönen ein vernichtungssüchtiger Reiz. Wilde Lust, Akkorde stören die Verzweiflung eisgetrun. Wie ein blasser Tropfen Bluts färbt die Lippen einer Kranken. Eis und Jauchzen süß und schmachtend, melancholisch düsterer Walzer, kommst mir nie mehr aus dem Sinn, haftest mir an den Gedanken, wie ein blasser Tropfen Bluts.
Schoenberg surrounds these poems with a prismatic chamber ensemble, five players playing eight instruments, piano, three strings, and four woodwinds, from piccolo down to bass clarinet. In various recombinations, they capture the icy, glistening but disjointed moonlit world of Giraud's creepy poems. All the instruments appear together only in the lovely, very last song, O Ancient Scent from Far Off Days. Many later composers have written works for the same ensemble so they could be performed on programs that include Pierrot Lunaire. There's often been a question about how much expression the reciter should have. Some people feel the poem should be delivered with a cool detachment. Schoenberg's own half-century-old recording is grandly passionate. So is the new one by Pierre Boulez and his luminous Ensemble Intercontemporain, with soprano Christine Schaefer, who can sometimes sound almost like an instrument herself. 1999 marks the 125th anniversary of Schoenberg's birth. No composer of this century challenged our common assumptions about music more. Many people still hate his music. He might be the most controversial composer of all time, though he was confident that someday he'd be better understood, perhaps even loved. Maybe that's what really drew Schoenberg to a group of poems about a moonstruck clown.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new recording on Deutsche Grammophon of Arnold Schoenberg's Pierrot Lunaire, conducted by Pierre Boulez. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Phyllis Myers, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Kathy Wolfe. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Ken Tucker. ¶¶